I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Welcome to the Fried Egg Golf Podcast. I'm Garrett Morrison, and today we're talking about the history of the golf architecture at Augusta National Golf Club. This is the fifth installment of our Great Courses series. These are basically deep dives into golf courses that have really shaped the game. And my guest for this episode is Joshua Pettit. Josh is a golf architect and a historical researcher. His firm is called Pacific Golf Design, and he's also the founder of the Alistair McKenzie Institute. Recently, Josh edited and published the McKenzie Reader, which is a truly impressive collection of Alistair McKenzie's writings on golf architecture and more. And today, Josh and I are going to dig into where the golf course at Augusta National came from. Of course, Augusta National was designed by Bobby Jones and Alistair McKenzie, and so Josh knows a great deal about its origins, what it was like initially, what its philosophy of design was, how it evolved over time. Josh has a lot of information about those subjects and, you know, a lot of stuff that I really didn't know before I started talking to him. So I'm really looking forward to this conversation. I think it'll be a great way to kick off the run-up to the Masters. But first, a word from our sponsor, Oars & Alps. Oars & Alps makes skincare products designed with men's needs in mind. They're built for an active, on-the-go lifestyle, and they use clean, powerful ingredients. So here are some facts for you about sun care that I think you should know. Skin cancer rates have risen 55% among men in the past decade. Golfers in particular are 250% more likely to develop skin cancers, yet only 14% of men wear sunscreen daily. Even though wearing sunscreen daily will reduce your risk of melanoma by 50%. So what Oars & Alps does is design products that take down some of the barriers that prevent men from wearing sunscreen. First of all, they have a kind of neutral smell for the most part, so you won't smell like a coconut or a banana. You won't get greasy hands from them, no weird residues. They're simple, easy to use, and most are travel friendly. One specific Oars & Alps product that I'd like to highlight is the Hydrating SPF 50 Spray. This is a top seller for Oars & Alps. It was chosen by Men's Health Magazine as an editor's choice, and it has become a real standard and go-to for me personally. So many things about this spray are right on the money. It's a non-greasy formula. It's water and sweat resistant. It has a light and subtle fragrance. They call it the Summer Splash scent at Oars & Alps. And it's also available in SPF 30 and 70, as well as a travel size option. That's the Hydrating Spray. Really great product. So for Fried Egg listeners, Oars & Alps is offering a great deal. 15% off with the code EGG15. That's EGG15 at oarsandalps.com/friedegg. Again, code EGG15, 15% off, oarsandalps.com/friedegg. Check them out. All right. I am here with Josh Pettit. Josh, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great.
So we're talking about the history of the golf architecture at Augusta National. This is a big and complex story. Why don't we just start with a basic narrative about the founding of the club? Where did the club come from and what were its intentions at the beginning?
Sure. Well, Bobby Jones, as you know, was probably the best golfer of at least the early 20th century, some people say ever. And in the 20s, especially, he traveled a lot, played a lot of competitions in the British Isles and all over the States. And he really fell in love with golf course design during that time period. And I think it was probably somewhere in the mid to late 20s, he started thinking about the idea of building his own golf course at some point. It was sort of always in the back of his head. So by 1930 or so, he was really thinking about this a lot. And I guess the best way to set it up maybe is, you know, he had met Mackenzie in 1927 when he was over playing at the Open at St. Andrews. And Mackenzie and him had some correspondence prior to that because of the 26 matches, the Walker Cup matches and the Open in 26. And Mackenzie was over there following both of those matches. Mackenzie had given him a copy of his book, Golf Architecture, that he inscribed. And so they had started a bit of a correspondence. And then you fast forward a couple of years to September of 1929. And this was the first time that Pebble Beach had hosted a major championship event. And it was the National Amateur, which nowadays we call the U.S. Amateur. But it was the first time that the USGA had hosted an event west, a big championship event west of the Mississippi. And so Bobby Jones went out to Pebble Beach for that. And of course, Mackenzie was living there at the time. And they played Cypress Point as sort of a warm-up round. But a funny thing happened. Bobby Jones, who had just won the U.S. Open the year prior, lost in his first round match at Pebble and was knocked out. You know, it was match play, all match play in those days. And he decided to stay for a few days and drove up to Pasatiempo, which is about an hour north in Santa Cruz, where they had an opening round match to commemorate the opening of the course. And so during this few days or a week or so, he spent a lot of time with Mackenzie, and you got to see his work at Cypress Point and at Pasatiempo and the renovation work that he and his partner, Robert Hunter and Chandler Egan, had done at Pebble Beach. And during this time, they spent a lot of time talking about golf course design and, you know, their shared ideals. You know, they both had a mutual love and admiration for the old course. So they really bonded over their love for St. Andrews. And when Bobby Jones saw Pasatiempo, he was just enthralled with sort of the development model, which was this, you know, kind of recreational residential community, you know, where they had like horseback riding trails and golf and tennis, and then, you know, a residential development surrounding all of that. And he kind of used that as his model, you know, eventually for what would become Augusta. So that struck up the relationship, and that's how Bobby Jones went on to hire Mackenzie. And he found the piece of land in Georgia the following year, and which had been a tree nursery. It propagated fruit trees, which actually that's where, interestingly enough, like all of the peach trees in Georgia had originated from. And that's sort of the founder of that nursery, Prosper Berkman's, was kind of thought of as like the Johnny Appleseed of peaches in Georgia. And so they converted this fruit tree nursery into what would become Augusta National.
Let's talk about Bobby Jones first a bit. By this point in his career, in his life, he had some pretty sophisticated ideas about golf architecture himself. It wasn't just Alistair Mackenzie who was bringing that to the partnership. And so, you know, aside from his relationship with Mackenzie and his conversations and correspondence with him, what do you think were some of the influences on Bobby Jones and his thinking about golf course design?
As I mentioned, he was in love with the old course at this point. You know, we all know the story of his first time playing the old course, where he ripped up his scorecard and walked off. But he came to later love the old course and many of the other links courses in the British Isles, and really keenly studied them. And Mackenzie alluded to this in an article he wrote. You know, he said he was so impressed with Bobby Jones's recollection of all of the famous links holes on all the links, all the best links courses. And Mackenzie was just very, very impressed by this. You know, when they were talking about inspiration for different holes, he just had a great photographic memory. So the idea that he and Mackenzie both were simpatico with was this idea of how do you build a golf course that's enjoyable for all classes of players, but also challenging to professionals in competitive play. And they both were in a total agreement that the old course in those days was the paramount example of this. And so that was really the inspiration. I mean, they took inspiration from some other holes, and Mackenzie lists these in his article of a lot of the holes they were inspired by, but many of them were from the old course. So their approach was essentially, how do we build the world's best inland golf course on this sort of site with heavy clay soils but try to replicate a lot of the features that you'd find on the old course and other, you know, some of the best links courses.
All right. And then let's pick up with Alistair McKenzie. Now this is a big story. We don't have to talk about all of his career, but I think it would be interesting to try to situate the Augusta National Project in Alistair McKenzie's career, because it really is toward the end of it. And so if you were to tell a story about how McKenzie's philosophy of design developed over the long term and eventually arrived at the place that it was at Augusta National, what would that story be?
Sure. So there's a few factors here. At the outset of McKenzie's career, you know, this was like coming out of the Victorian era of golf design, or some call it the Dark Ages. You know, so this is early, you know, first few years of the 20th century. And golf had been booming in Britain. And so there was a lot of golf courses being built inland at that point, but they were all like very rudimentary in nature, very mathematically laid out. And McKenzie and his partner, Harry Colt, would later say that they were built in a way that was offensive to the eye. So they were essentially just trying to crank out golf courses because there was such demand to play. And
this was like the 1890s and maybe even into the early 1900s,
exactly,
when golf was really expanding and expanding inland, but maybe they didn't quite know how to build inland courses yet.
Exactly. Exactly. And it was well recognized by those guys that all the best courses were, you know, these old links courses that essentially were built by nature. And the clubs that found them, you know, figured out ways to route holes around these, all these natural dunes. But, you know, when you went inland and started building all these golf courses, there was nothing like that. So McKenzie started, you know, we don't have to get into the whole story of his time in South Africa in the Boer War, but that's when he picked up this concept of camouflage from the Boers and how they manipulated the landscape in ways and created landforms to trick the enemy and to disguise themselves. And he was thinking in terms of that, like, how could I apply that concept to building golf courses on all of these inland, largely featureless flat sites with usually heavy clay soils? So that was like the initial concept, the novel idea in 1907, when McKenzie, he was one of the founders of Allwoodley, and designed that course. And that was his sort of first attempt at this. So you fast forward several years, and he had the opportunity to come to the States and start building a lot of golf courses here when everything was booming. So the other piece to this too is he always thought about economics. He was sort of an amateur economist, and he, you know, in the back of his head was always the idea of the economics of designing, building, and maintaining the golf course. But I guess what changed sort of in the, you know, at the end of the 20s was the Great Depression hit in 29. And so by the time he started building Augusta in 1931, 32, they were, you know, full in the midst of the Great Depression. And at that point, McKenzie had been thinking a little differently than he had prior, which was like, how do I build a course as economically as possible? And at Augusta, we see this in his economy of bunkering, where originally there was 36 bunkers on the course, and he knocked down 14 of those, and he ended up with only 22 bunkers. So you contrast that with a lot of his courses he was building just a few years prior that would have 100 or more bunkers in a lot of cases. And for those of us that have worked in the golf course maintenance industry and construction business, building and maintaining bunkers is, you know, very antithetical to economization of construction and maintenance. So that was kind of the driving factor. Just prior to building Augusta, he built a course called Bayside on Long Island. And this was actually a public daily fee course. And it had only 19 bunkers originally. And he talked about this when he was building Augusta, how he learned a lot of lessons from his time building Bayside that helped him a lot during the construction at Augusta. So, you know, again, he was trying to build, you know, like a links-like course on an inland site, but do it as economically possible.
So if you were going to look at some of McKenzie's courses leading up to Augusta National, which ones would you pick out as being particularly significant or showing some kind of development or evolution in his design, just in those kind of last few years before the beginning of the 1930s? What should people think about?
Mackenzie was so good about adapting to the site that he had. You know, like, for instance, if you look at like some of the famous courses that people would know that he was building in that time frame, you know, Cypress Point was probably the most famous example. And then just prior to that was Royal Melbourne, and very, very different sites. And then Pasatiempo a year or so later, and that's also a very different site than Cypress Point. And so I would say the things that started changing were, like I just mentioned, the onset of the Depression and this concept of economization. So I think the two that I would really point to that were really important leading up to Augusta were the Jockey Club in Buenos Aires, Argentina. He built two courses, 36 holes there. And he did that on a completely like dead flat piece of land. And so in order to, first of all, create interest, and then second of all, engineer it correctly so that the water could drain off the property, he cut this series of swales running through the property and then used the material to shape all these interesting landforms for the green complexes. And it's just amazing if you look at that golf course, what he was able to do with a dead flat piece of property, and also did it very economically. Very few amount of bunkers, and the strategy was devised largely from the landforms. You know, at this point, he was thinking more and more in terms of how do I create strategic value using landforms and short grass instead of bunkers or other hazards. So, you know, after he built the Jockey Club and then building Bayside in New York, those are the two that I think really, really influenced his thinking when he started to build Augusta. And the other thing too that's important to know is this is right at the time when heavy equipment was just starting to be used in golf course construction. Prior to that, most of the courses Mackenzie built in the 20s, they were shaped with horses and scrapers and plows. And it was a very manual, labor-intensive process, which actually resulted in these really beautiful landforms. But toward the end of the 1920s, the first property actually he ever used mechanical equipment on was the Valley Club in Montecito, Santa Barbara, which is where you're from, I think.
Yep, that's where I grew up. I didn't grow up at the Valley Club, but it's a beautiful course, kind of built into some canyons and ravines outside of Santa Barbara. Just a gorgeous golf course.
So for anybody that's been there, that golf course is sort of split up into two sides. There's a road that goes through it, Sheffield, and on the maintenance side, there's 10 holes. That side of the course was very, very rocky, all these just huge boulders. And so that was the first time he used a bulldozer to move. They just used it to move boulders around and then to cover boulders with dirt. He didn't use it to shape any features, really. But then fast forward a couple of years when he's building Bayside in New York, that was the first place where he actually shaped the green complexes with what we now know as a bulldozer. It was kind of rudimentary in those days. And then he did the same thing at Augusta, reshaped the greens with dozers. So that fed into the economization of the construction.
Does Pasatiempo fit in anywhere here? I mean, in terms of economy of construction, certainly there are a lot of bunkers at Pasatiempo, bunkers used as kind of land art. But, you know, are there some ways in which maybe there are parallels between Pasatiempo and Augusta National, especially considering Pasatiempo was fairly late in the 1920s?
Yeah, I do think at that point he was starting to build wilder greens. So that's probably the best way to think of it. You know, his first course he built in the States was the Meadow Club, just north of San Francisco, starting in 1926, opened in 1927. And those greens were fairly mild. And as he started building Pasatiempo, Cypress Point to a certain extent, but even more so at Pasatiempo, he started building wilder greens. And when he got to Augusta, he was very comfortable with building these pretty severe, what some people might characterize as unfair greens, with just wild moving landforms.
The shapes of the greens kind of stick with me from Pasatiempo. they're so distinctive. They're kind of like these amoeba shapes, aside from the internal contours, which on some greens are extremely severe. The outlines of the greens kind of became different for McKenzie. He started kind of wrapping the putting surface around bunkers. And if you look at early photos of Augusta National, not to get ahead of ourselves here, but a lot of the greens are kind of like that, with these strange little tongues that go out in unexpected directions.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, and there might be something to that. And it, sure, at that point, he was definitely experimenting with a lot of these tongues that stuck out. And they were, in those days, that was like nobody was building greens like that. But I would also say that McKenzie didn't really think in two dimension. He was really just thinking 3D and how to create these pin locations. And, you know, in the case of Augusta, I think he and Bobby Jones had talked about that they could not envision what the Masters has become today. But they had talked about, you know, having it used for some sort of competitive venue.
So getting to the job itself, mentioned that McKenzie had a pre-existing connection with Bobby Jones. That was likely why he was brought in to work on the course. Were there any other candidates for this job? Any other people that Jones could have or would have been expected to work with? Or was it just McKenzie?
Sure. So this is somewhat speculation on my part, but I think there's others that have sort of made the same point as well. And in those days, especially on the East Coast, Donald Ross was sort of the predominant architect. And McKenzie wasn't doing a lot of work on the East, I mean, other than that course in New York. And then in the Midwest, you know, he had built Crystal Downs. But Donald Ross was building courses everywhere, all over the East Coast, including the neighboring Augusta Country Club, which borders Augusta National. And so,
and also Eastlake, right? Eastlake, where Bobby Jones grew up playing.
Right, exactly. So I've never seen anything written about this from either Bobby Jones or McKenzie or Donald Ross. But the thinking would be like, it would be pretty logical if he had hired Donald Ross to build Augusta. And then were there other candidates? I've never seen anything to indicate that. I just think that he and Bobby struck up such a friendship over their love for the old course. And then the time they spent together out in California at Pebble Beach and at Cypress Point and Pasatiempo, I think in the eyes of, again, I'm sort of speculating here, but in the eyes of Bobby Jones, he was just the clear candidate to build Augusta. Now, the other thing I will say is, and McKenzie kind of alludes to this in some of his writings, I would say that Bobby Jones, if he had wanted to, he could have probably designed the course himself on his own. And somebody with maybe a bit less humility probably would have. I mean, Bobby Jones had the knowledge base, I would say, to build a pretty good golf course in those days. But he was a pretty humble guy, actually. And he was smart enough to realize, you know, he needed a partner, as a professional. And, you know, he was wise enough to partner with McKenzie. But McKenzie was so impressed, as I said, with Jones's recollection of all the best holes. And he talks about how the course could not have been any close to as good as it was if it weren't for the contributions that Bobby Jones made.
Yeah, when you read Bobby Jones on golf courses, it's clear that he was one of the brains behind this project, right? You know, obviously Alistair McKenzie's writings are impressive to a degree that is, you know, unparalleled in golf writing, but Bobby Jones's thoughts about the golf courses that he has played and about Augusta National specifically were always incredibly sophisticated. And that's, I don't know, it's something that has always jumped out at me. Now, getting to the philosophy of this design, you know, what they intended to do with the design at Augusta National, you've already mentioned that it was meant as an ode to the old course and to Lynx Golf. And it's always been funny to me that they tried to do that on this site, because it's almost like they gave themselves the biggest challenge possible. If you want to replicate the old course, then you're not going to choose a huge hillside with massive back to front elevation change. You're not going to choose a tree covered property. You're not going to choose a clay based site. Like, all of these things are the opposite of the old course's environment. And yet they attempted to do something like the old course at Augusta National. So could you talk about how they tried to carry that out on this site, trying to import this concept to a site that would seem to reject it?
Yeah, it is very counterintuitive. And, you know, in those days, the construction methodologies clearly weren't as advanced as they are now. And we didn't have all these things like sub-air systems. And, you know, they didn't have the ability to build that kind of infrastructure. But they did recognize the inherent value of the land itself, which, yeah, it's not really a good comp to St. Andrews because the elevation changes are so significant. But he did see opportunities in all of these scenarios to draw inspiration from a certain hole on either St. Andrews or some other links courses, and not to replicate those holes, because as Mackenzie would say, that would be futile to try to do that, but to just take inspiration from the concepts of those holes, the strategic principles, and then apply them to the site at Augusta. I think the other thing was that they knew it was going to be a seasonal property. It was going to be kind of a winter resort. So, you know, in January, February, March, essentially, was going to be the main season, because most of the initial members were all sort of based in the New York area, some in Atlanta. You know, so the climate was conducive to having like a winter golf getaway. So, you know, as far as how they were able to replicate the old course or those principles, you know, he found certain sites on all of these holes that he was laying out, where he just figured out how he could adapt without doing too much to the earth, but doing enough, you know? So like I said, they had dozers. They did have to cut down a lot of trees. It was pretty densely forested. And so, yeah, all those are contradictory to the way the old course was built. But again, this all stemmed from Mackenzie's sort of career-long ambition was to, how can I replicate Lynx Golf on non-Lynx land?
Are there any particular holes that people could look at and discern some kind of old course influence?
Yeah. So he lists them in a great article that's in my book, and it's called Plans for the Ideal Golf Course. And he sort of lists them, kind of goes hole by hole and gives a quick hole description. And so starting out, you know, they're not all templates, but a lot of them sort of are. And yeah, templates isn't really the right word. He probably wouldn't like that word, but the starting with like the fourth hole, which is that par three, that's his version of the Eden, the 11th of St. Andrews. And then the fifth hole was like his version of the road hole, but it was reversed. And then the sixth hole was that another par three. That was his version of a Redan, you know, the 15th at North Berwick. And then the seventh, which I think we want to talk about a little bit later, that was kind of his version of the 18th at St. Andrews, particularly with the green, which was, you know, modeled, inspired by the Valley of Sin green at St. Andrews. And then the eighth hole, which is a par five, you know, uphill, that green complex, not really the hole, but the green complex is sort of a punch bowl green surrounded by these hillocks. That was inspired by the 17th at Muirfield. And then like the ninth hole was sort of a take on a cape. You know, he also references like on the 10th hole, he sort of compared it to his 13th hole at Cypress Point, that par four, and also the fourth at Alwoodley, the old fourth, because the routing has been changed. The 11th hole, he kind of goes out of his way to say, this is like a very novel hole. He's never seen any hole like it anywhere. And that was like a very unique concept for a hole. And then 13, the famous par five Azalea, he sort of compared that to the 17th at Cypress Point that he built, you know, in reverse. And then the 14th was sort of modeled after the sixth at St. Andrews. And then the 16th, well, the old 16th, which is no longer there, that's the one hole that's completely different currently. But the old 16th was a par three that you hit over a little creek. And that was modeled off of what was the seventh hole at a course called Stoke Poges in England.
And, a Harry Colt course, right?
Yeah. And but he sort of gave it a little dig and said, like, well, we did a much better job, and this site is this, you know, this site that we have to work with is much more visually beautiful. So we sort of one-upped it. But and then the 17th, the green at 17 was sort of modeled off of the 14th at St. Andrews, but sort of reversed. So those were sort of, you know, kind of he lays out the inspiration for each of those holes where, you know, where the initial concepts came from. But again, he wasn't trying to copy these by any stretch. He was trying to adapt them. And the other thing I like to, I think is really interesting, is he also wrote about how he was so pleased. He and Bobby Jones were so both pleased with the holes that they created, this collection of holes that they created. And he had hoped that in the future, people would do the same thing that they did, and that they would take inspiration from many of these holes at Augusta and apply them to other sites, and not copy them, but just take the inspiration and adapt them to new sites. And I always kind of think of that in terms of, there's a lot of analogies you can make to other art forms, but like in music, for instance, musicians always talk about how they're kind of recycling their influences and kind of doing their own take, a sort of more modern take on the music that inspired them. And you can kind of trace the lineage of this, like through, you know, blues and rock and roll. And so I think that was kind of the same mindset that he had with golf holes. And the idea of trying to, you know, take inspiration from these holes, it was in homage to them. It was like out of respect almost and admiration. It wasn't like, oh, you know, it wasn't cynical in a way that we want to copy these holes because they're good.
Did he ever talk about C.B. McDonald and his ideal holes? Because what you're saying is might be similar in some ways to McDonald's approach, but I don't know if McKenzie ever thought through that link between him and McDonald specifically.
It's a great question. He didn't really write anything to that effect, but I think it's safe to say that, you know, similar thinking there. I don't think McDonald really referred to his holes as templates either. Maybe you know better than me.
No, he called them ideal holes. It was never templates. I'm not sure where templates came from, just much as I'm later. Not sure where the golden age of golf architecture came from. All these words we use to refer to this era now are not exactly rooted in historical fact.
Absolutely. Yeah. My guess is that McDonald wouldn't really care for the term template, you know, as characterizing what he did. But I think it's safe to say that, yeah, like conceptually, the intellectual exercise was very similar to what McKenzie was doing.
All right. So, you know, before getting into how the course was when it initially opened and then how it evolved, I wonder if there are any stories that you have from construction that you think about regularly. I honestly haven't heard that much about the construction of Augusta National specifically, and whether, you know, anything went interestingly wrong, or you know, whether anything happened during that period.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anything went wrong necessarily, but there's a few things here. One is, yeah, definitely the economic climate really influenced and changed right out of the gate what they were trying to do. I meant to mention earlier that initially they had wanted to build two golf courses. They wanted 36 holes. And surrounding those 36 holes were going to be lots, residential lots that they would sell to private owners that could build their own houses, similar to, as I mentioned, what they did at Paso Tiempo. But when they kind of got the surveys and started plotting everything out on actually these topo maps that I have, they realized that they didn't really have quite enough land to make two great golf courses and have space for the lots and other sort of amenities that they wanted. So right out of the gate, they shifted and they said, all right, we're just going to focus on building one course. And then this later fed into them deciding to build, they had at least the plan to build a par three course. So instead of building two 36 hole full 18 hole courses, they thought, well, we'll build one 18 hole quote unquote championship course, or the long course, and then we'll have a short par three course. And that in and of itself is a fascinating story, which I'm happy to talk about. But back to the construction for a minute. When they started building it, yeah, it was heavily forested. They had to cut down a lot of trees. So they had these big crews, pretty labor intensive, grueling labor, but they were just cutting trees down, pulling out the roots. But the construction went pretty quickly. They did it all beginning to end in 4 months, and they worked like sun up to sundown, and it was probably pretty grueling, but it went quick. And I think that, you know, the utilizing bulldozers and other heavy equipment, that helped the process, definitely.
What happened with the par three course?
Well, so McKenzie laid out a plan for an 18-hole par three course that consisted of 9 double greens. You know, going back to St. Andrews, they both love St. Andrews so much. And 7 of the greens at St. Andrews are double greens. They, you know, 14 holes use those seven greens and you hit them to them from opposite angles. So his concept with the short course was 18 holes, par three course, nine greens that you hit into from opposite directions, and it creates an 18-hole routing. And that routing was actually, he previously had designed a course in Argentina, a private estate course called El Boquerón. Similar concept, but it wasn't just par threes. It was par threes and par fours, nine double greens, which never actually got built. So then the par three course at Augusta, when he laid it out, he drew the plan. Bobby Jones didn't like the fact that two of the holes crossed a service road. And he kind of mentioned that he didn't really like that very much. But it didn't really matter because the financials of the development were so strapped, they barely got the project finished. And by the end of it, they were, in debt to contractors, and they, it was very difficult for them to even just finish the first golf course. And so they never even started building the par three course, which is, I think, a bit sad. But, you fast forward to 1957 and George Cobb built the current par three course on the same site. It's a 20-acre site. And that's what they play, the par three competition on every Wednesday before the Masters.
Are there any plans for this original par three course concept out there?
Yeah. I found the plan, 12 years ago or something like that. When I found it, I am fairly confident that nobody, at least in the golf space, who knew what it was, had seen it probably since 1932 or 33, because there's only one plan in existence. It's actually stored in the Olmsted Brothers Archive, which is in Brookline, Massachusetts. And, I'd seen some things written alluding to the fact that McKenzie had done a plan for a par three course there, but no one had ever seen it. And then I found it. And so you can find it. It's in my book, the McKenzie Reader. The Olmsted Archive was gracious to give me permission to print it in the book, and it's on my website and it's floating around. I think it's posted on some of my social media. And so it's been around, it's been circulating. You can find it. It's just a fascinating plan.
Well, I wonder if anybody's gonna take that and try to rebuild it at some point. Not to give anybody any ideas, but that would seem to be low hanging fruit for some people with the money to do it.
I've been working on that for years. We'll see. Hopefully we'll find the right site at some point.
So, in other words, if you do it, hire Josh. that would only be fair. I wanted to take a quick break here to talk about Club Champion. Club Champion helps golfers of any skill level play better golf through custom fitted and custom built equipment. Their extensively trained master fitters provide an in-depth, data-driven tour level fitting process with 50,000 hittable head and shaft combos in the shop, as well as 60 plus brands. They use industry-leading technology like TrackMan and Sam Putlab, and they build to the tightest tolerances in the industry. Club Champion's fittings produce real results for every level of player, which include an average of 22-yard increases off the tee and 10-yard improvements in dispersion. Club Champion fittings, for me personally, have been incredibly revealing. I don't think I'm unique in the sense that before I went to Club Champion, I didn't really have any idea what I should be playing, or at least I had ideas that turned out to be erroneous. And so going to Club Champion and working with a master fitter and actually seeing what was going on with my ball flight, spin, all that kind of stuff, launch angle, that was surprising to me. I discovered a lot of things that I didn't know before, and I learned more about what kind of equipment allows me to play my best golf. So going to Club Champion is about getting equipment that works for you, yes, but it's also about this kind of education process. So for Fried Egg listeners, here is the deal that Club Champion is offering. Right now, you can use code FRIEDEGG to get 50% off the cost of your fitting with the purchase of a club. So go to clubchampion.com and book your fitting today. Again, that's code FRIEDEGG, all one word. So getting back to the main course, you know, obviously when Augusta National originally opened its 18-hole course, the hole numbering was different. And fairly early on in the course's life, they decided to flip the nines. And so now we have the sequence that we're all familiar with today, the great back nine at Augusta National. Everybody says, you know, it's one of the best back nines in golf. It's so dramatic. It produces such great tournament Sundays. But of course, that was initially the front nine. So why did they decide to flip the nines? And was there thinking behind having the nines the way they were originally?
All right. So this is a great question that I think people have speculated about for a while. And I think most people get it wrong. Mackenzie drew three routing plans for Augusta, for the main course at Augusta, not the par three course. The first one was from July 1931. And the very first plan is the current day routing with the nines the way they are configured currently. The second two plans he did, both in 1932, one was in July, one was in November, I think. Those both showed the nines flipped, what you're talking about. And then when they opened the course in 33, and then they did the first Masters in 34, they used that flipped routing for some reason. And I don't know why. I don't have a great answer. I've never read anything or seen anything that explains what the thought process was there. But then the following Masters, the second Masters in 1935, they flipped the nines back to Mackenzie's very first routing, which is now the present day routing, which is, I think, you know, clearly a much better routing, especially on a Sunday of the Masters. You know, that back nine is just the drama that it provides is pretty much unparalleled, I would say, in competitive golf. So, I mean, it's hard to imagine them ending on the front nine. It just doesn't make sense. So I don't know why they flipped them and then flipped them back. I did hear a story that, and I don't know if it's true, that the thinking as to why they flipped it back after the first Masters was because of frost delays that they had on those first few holes, like 10, 11, and somehow those holes thawed out slower than the rest of the course. And so that's why they flipped them back. I don't know. That doesn't really make sense to me, but you know, I think it's more that back nine is just a far superior finishing nine for competition play.
That's really clarifying, because it would be weird to me to imagine the course ending with the sequence of 7, 8, 9,
right,
even as originally built. I mean, maybe it would be kind of cool to have a drivable par 4 16th hole, which would be 7. We can, you know, address that more in depth in a minute here. But just a strange idea to flip those around. The frost delay thing, you know, kind of does make sense in a way, or maybe it's like a drainage issue even, where 10, 11, 12, those are very low-lying holes.
Right.
Whereas the front nine is mostly sort of up, more up on the hill. And so maybe those holes just drained a little better up there, and so they wanted to give the lower-lying holes. I don't know.
Could be something to that. And actually, that's why that was one of the main factors as to why they moved the 10th green, was because of drainage problems.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about some holes that were different in the early 1930s than what they are today, than the forms that everybody's familiar with. Everybody knows, you know, all golf fans know every hole at Augusta National at this point. But one of the cool things about looking at the original iteration of the course is just how different and how strange in some cases certain original holes were. So why don't we start with the one that we've mentioned a couple of times already, number 7. What was that hole initially?
Okay, at the outset of this, let me just say, I'm going to post on my Twitter and Instagram a couple of maps. So by the time this is live, if people want to like follow along visually, I think it really helps if you want to look at some of these old maps and look at the old configurations of these holes. I think that's pretty useful. But all of the green, like starting with all of the greens, let's say, they were initially, you know, originally they were 50% bigger than they currently are on average. The original greens averaged 9,600 square feet, which are pretty big greens. And the 13th green was the biggest, you know, it was over 13,000 square feet. Currently, the greens average like 6,400 square feet and some change. So, you know, they're 33% smaller than they were. But the seventh hole in particular, that was, as we talked about earlier, sort of modeled after the 18th at St. Andrews. Short par four, the green was modeled after the Valley of Sin green. And, you know, Bobby Jones wrote that it didn't play very well in competition. It was too easy and it wasn't challenging enough, I guess. And so in 37 or 38 is when he started working with Perry Maxwell. This is after Mackenzie had passed away. You know, Mackenzie had died in January of 1934, 2 months before the first Masters. And then luckily, I think Bobby Jones was wise enough to consult with Perry Maxwell, who had been a partner of Mackenzie's. And so Maxwell was very sympathetic and careful with what he did there. But, you know, to make Bobby Jones happy and others, they pushed back the green 35 yards, made it much longer, and added a couple bunkers. And then it's evolved a lot since then, even. You know, they've added more bunkers surrounding the green, and they've narrowed the fairway significantly. I think currently it's the narrowest hole on the property, with a lot of tree plantings and narrowing the fairway. So, yeah, if you look at the current seventh hole and the original seventh hole, you probably wouldn't even really recognize them. You know, they're very, very different.
Let's go to number 10. What was this hole initially? And then this is another one where Perry Maxwell came in and oversaw the changes that ended up happening. So take us through the evolution of this hole.
Yeah, so this was a very, very steep downhill par four. You know, I think the elevation change from tee to green is just over 100 feet, which is very, very significant drop for like a 425-yard par four, which is what it was originally. And it, on occasion, it was drivable. You know, I think when it was firm and being that far downhill and maybe if you had a breeze behind you, but people wrote that it was occasionally drivable in those days. But there was, you know, up by the green, there were sort of two big landforms. There was one convex landform that Mackenzie built, that giant bunker that we all sort of recognize. It's really the only recognizable bunker currently on the golf course that has all those tongues and those capes and bays. And just to the right of that was this concave landform, sort of a bowl that Mackenzie built that green in. So it's sort of a punch bowl green next to a giant bunker. And yeah, apparently, you know, it always had drainage problems. So when Perry Maxwell came in, he built a new green about 30 yards further down the fairway, left that bunker there, which is a bit curious, and built the new green. And that also sort of meaningfully changed the 11th hole because they had to move the tee for the 11th hole to the left, which made the dogleg on 11 a lot less sharp. Previously, 11 had a much sharper dogleg. And then I think since then, the green on 10 has been rebuilt even at least once more.
Yeah, we kind of have to talk about these holes in tandem, you know, the 10th hole and the 11th hole, because as you say, you know, they moved the 10th green to a place where they could no longer keep the 11th tee where it was, which was to the right of the 10th hole corridor, which made the 11th hole a pretty sharp dogleg to the right, whereas now it is more or less a straightaway hole. But, you know, first of all, with number 10, the original hole, the strategy was kind of interesting in the sense that it's almost the opposite of what it is now, I guess, in terms of angles. Because now what you're really trying to do, or at least what the pros are trying to do, is like hook it around the trees on the left to try to get that speed slot, shorten the hole, and also find a somewhat easier angle into the green, because it's very hard to approach that green from the right side of the corridor.
Right.
The original number 10, if you got over to the left, you were screwed because you had that big famous bunker and you were hitting this like chip over the bunker to a little green on the other side. That's not where you wanted to be. You kind of wanted to be more out to the right. So kind of interesting how the redesigned hole flipped the strategy. It's still, I think, a terrific hole, but it's almost like a mirror image in terms of the angles.
Yeah.
And then the 11th hole changed a lot as well. There used to be a centerline bunker there. Could you talk a little bit more about that hole, tee to green?
Yeah, so the original tee on 11 was actually just behind the 10th green. So you'd walk off a 10 green and the 11th tee was right there, which if you're looking at a map is much further to the right than it currently is. So when they moved the 10th green back, they had to move the 11th green to the left which decreased that dogleg angle. And then over the years, they kept pushing the tee back further and further and further. So now it's like way back in the chute, and it's still
so far back. You have to go there to see this, but it is just like plunged back into the forest now.
Yeah, exactly. So you have to walk backwards, which is, you know, Mackenzie wouldn't be thrilled with that, but hey, you got to do something, you know, to protect it. So, but I mean, and it's still a bit of a dog leg, but it's not totally straight. It's just kind of a slight dog leg, but it was a very sharp dog leg originally. And the original idea for that hole was, and this is a great example of the design of the green complex, you know, is integral to your tee shot. And so if you're teeing off on the original 11th hole, the best place to place your tee shot is as far left in the fairway as possible, because there was this little stream that guarded the front left of the green. And I realize this may sound counterintuitive if you're not looking at a plan, but the reason being is that to the front and the right of the green complex were these two big mounds, and they were sort of like feeder mounds, where if you aim for those mounds and landed a ball short of the green, it would bump you up into the green. And the best way you could utilize those mounds was by being as far left in the fairway as possible. And actually, originally there was not a bunker in the fairway. That centerline bunker was not there. There was no bunkers on that hole at all, actually, originally. And then I think in 35 or 36, for either the second or the third Masters, Bobby Jones, it was his idea actually to put that centerline bunker there, which I don't know who built that, because I believe that was prior to Maxwell doing consulting with them. But I did read that it wasn't built in a way where you could visually see it from the tee. It was kind of obscured. So whoever built it probably didn't do a great job. And then the following year, they took it out. So that bunker was only there for like a year, I think.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's a new one for me. I actually recently saw a photo of this bunker for the first time I can remember. This is probably all very familiar to you, Josh, but Simon Haynes on Twitter has been kind of experimenting with little colorizations of some old photographs of Augusta National. And they're really interesting to look at. But he has one of 11 that does show that bunker. I guess the photo was taken right when that bunker was there. And as I was kind of looking at it in this photo, I was like, this bunker looks kind of, this looks kind of weird. Like it's not fully realized in the way that most Alistair Mackenzie bunkers look. So,
I don't know if I've seen that photo. I'll have to look for that. You're saying it's taken from the ground perspective.
From the ground perspective, maybe somewhere in the vicinity of the tee, but it's the first time that I've ever seen a representation of that visually. So I'll have to look that up on Simon Haynes's Twitter account and discuss that with you, because that was the first time I had seen something like that. In any case, moving on through the back nine, one kind of sneaky hole that has evolved quite a bit over time is 15. And, you know, the basic routing layout concept of the hole is similar now to what it used to be. You know, instead of a stream, there's a pond, all the usual kind of stuff that has changed on a lot of holes at Augusta National has changed on 15. But I wonder if you could talk about the sheer width of the original 15th hole and what that meant about how the hole played.
Sure. Well, you know, all the holes were wider in those days, and there was only a single cut of grass. So there was no secondary cut, no rough. It was just all short grass, you know, and then tees and greens. And they hadn't yet, you know, they had cleared so many trees and they had created these pretty wide playing corridors. And it wasn't until decades later that they started planting trees again to narrow the fairways. So, you know, in those days, the entire course was a lot wider. You know, that's why it's kind of interesting to look at an old aerial photograph and compare it to today. And actually, there's like a really, really good Golf Digest did I think a year or two ago, they did an article thing where it's like this sort of interactive hole by hole guide to all the changes of the holes over the years. And they took like a couple of the routing plans that I gave them, and they have them like side by side. So you can kind of see the transition, and you could just see how much wider all those playing corridors were. But, you know, Bobby Jones and Mackenzie were going back to the old course, you know, their intent was to not constrict you off the tee at all. They wanted to give you optionality, and they wanted you to think about where you were going to place your tee shot and give you a lot of width to do that. And, you know, place a premium on certain sides of the fairways, depending on how the green was set up. So, you know, 15 was just like that. It was a lot wider. And if you were on the wrong side of the fairway, hitting that approach in was nearly impossible.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the, some original aerial photos of Augusta or look at the original design plans and things like that, the 15th fairway is like this hillside field. It is so wide. And one point of reference is that, you know, those trees, that the grove of trees that gets in the way now, if you're on the left side of the fairway, I don't think there were as many of those trees originally, but there were a couple and they were centerline.
Yeah.
So the fairway just extended right down the hillside into the 14th hole. And yeah, the length of the hole was almost kind of like the defense back then, along with the fronting hazard on the green.
And also it would depend on where the pin was on any given day. You know, it might influence if you decide to try to play left of those trees, the centerline trees, or right of the centerline trees.
Yeah. All right. You've referred to the 16th hole, mentioning that it was supposed to be modeled on a hole at Stoke Poges, which is a Harry Colt course in England. Could you give a more of a picture of what this hole was, and then why and how it was changed eventually by Robert Trent Jones?
Sure. Yeah. And I'll post some pictures of this too, because this is a hole that, like, if you looked at it, you wouldn't recognize it. And if you look at an old photo,
you can't even tell where it is now.
Right.
Like
you
kind of look at it and you're like, where exactly is this on the property?
You might be confused into thinking like, well, wait, is that 13 maybe? But because, you know, essentially it's the same. There's a creek crossing through. That's the tributary that goes into Ray's Creek. So it's the same tributary that crosses eventually in front of 13 green and goes along the 13th fairway and then ties into Ray's Creek right around, you know, 12 green, 13 tee. But as you played the 15th hole and you walked off the green, you'd walk off to the right of the green and the tee was there, and you would sort of play to the left, and the green was guarded by that creek. And then there's two little bunkers kind of up on the hillside to the left. And then currently the way it's changed is, you know, the new hole that Robert Trent Jones Sr. built just after World War II, I think like 1948, 49, you walk off to the left of the 15th green, and that's currently now where the tee is, and you play to the right. And they dammed up that creek to make a pond. And so as far as the routing flow, it's kind of interesting, because you can make an argument that it's actually it makes the routing flow a little better, because the current 16th green is now closer to the 17th tee. Whereas before, you had to walk sort of around across that creek from the 16th green over to the 17th tee. But I think in those days, you know, they weren't thinking in terms of damming up a creek, building a pond, you know, doing these kind of major engineering feats like that. And they wanted to utilize the natural features that they had as best as they could to create strategy without having to build too many bunkers or do too much artificial work. So I think it made sense in those days that they would have built that green there on that side of the creek.
Yeah. You know, it's a pretty looking hole when you see the original one, but obviously the Robert Trent Jones 16th hole has become iconic, right? That is you can't go back in history on that one, I think, because of what the new 16th hole has meant to so many Masters tournaments.
I've kind of thought it'd be kind of interesting. You know, they'll never do this, but so the old 16th green it sort of played as like a reverse Redan, actually, even though it was sort of a shorter hole. You know, it only played, I think, like 155 yards from the championship tee, but the space is there. If they wanted to, they could rebuild that 16th green as it was and keep the current 16th hole, and they'd be like crossing par threes. And for member play or for like an alternate hole in competition one day, you could play the old par three and then switch back to the Robert Trent Jones par three. I mean, the space is there to do it. it would encumber some of the gallery space that they use. So I doubt they would ever do that. But I actually have laid that out in CAD. I have a plan of how you could rebuild that original par three.
I've never heard that idea before, but I love it, obviously. They kind of do that at LACC North with the little 17th green that they still maintain. But of course, that's kind of tucked off to the side and doesn't really get in the way of anything. But that's a fun feature at that course. So, hey, why not? The last story about a hole that I'd like to get to is the eighth hole. And this takes us a little bit later in the history of the course. So could you just tell me the story of how the eighth hole got monkeyed with and then changed back?
Well, okay, so the eighth hole is an uphill par five, and the green is surrounded by these giant hillocks these landforms that they created. The closest thing that they remind me to are some of the green complexes they built at the Jockey Club in Argentina. We talked about that earlier. Completely artificially man-made, but just beautiful and so elegant. And the scale of them and the spacing is just, I think, phenomenal. And then the green was kind of like this punch bowl green that sits between them. And in 1957, Clifford Roberts, who was kind of the co-founder of Augusta with Bobby Jones, Clifford was kind of the finance admin side of the development, and he was kind of tied in. He was a financier and tied in with those circles in New York. He took a very active role, you know, in the first few decades of the club in sort of managing it. And he thought that those landforms, those mounds that they built, obscured the green so that it was hard for spectators to watch when they were playing the Masters. And so he decided it would be best to flatten them completely, flatten the green, and create this, I'm sure you've seen a photo of it, this just ludicrous looking green complex that just doesn't look anything like anything else that is at Augusta or anything that McKenzie would have ever built anywhere in his entire career. And then it only lasted, I think, a couple of years at the most. And I think there was just so much outrage that they went back and they tried to, they had photos and they did their best to restore the original green that they had.
I've heard a couple of different stories about how long this version of the eighth green lasted. One of those stories, I think maybe what I've heard is that, and it's funny how we're dealing in rumor here so much. This is not historical record that I'm talking about, but they altered the eighth green after that photo was taken. That is so funny looking. I mean, it just like a pancake, basically. if you were to invent the opposite of whatever that original green complex was, you know, with its kind of almost outrageous, big, you know, magnificent mounds. If you were to imagine the opposite of that, that's what the new version of the eighth green was. I think they altered it in some way a couple of years after, but that it wasn't fully restored to its original form. And they did a pretty good job in bringing it back to its original form, because if you look at it now and compare it to some of those 1930s photographs, like, pretty good. I don't think they brought it back fully until right after Clifford Roberts died, basically, and they brought in Byron Nelson to help.
Yeah, I have read that. They interviewed Byron and they were sort of picking his brain, like, well, how do you recall this and that? And, you know, like you said, they had the photos, but I think Byron Nelson had, like, you know, all this, you know, just detailed recollection from playing it so many years. That could be true. I think it only lasted a year. And then, yeah, maybe the restoration was a phase thing over a few years. But I think initially what happened was in 57, when they built that green, the new funky green, which, as you were saying that, I was kind of imagining, like, if you were to prompt ChatGPT to build, crank out something that would be the opposite of the eighth green, that's what it would crank out, probably, is something like that, like, yeah, the antithesis. But that was right at the time when they started consulting with George Cobb, the architect, and that was when George was building the par three course that we now see on TV. Well, that's been revised also, but generally that was, you know, what you see is largely the course that he built in 1957. think those things were happening concurrently, the eighth hole. And then the following year, I think in 1958, is when they put it back. So I'm pretty sure that was only in play for one Masters. And then, yeah, to your point, it could have been that they did their best initially to get it back, but then they realized like they needed to sort of augment it a little bit over a few years to try to get it as close as they could.
All right. So looking at the course now, considering how the course has evolved overall, there are a lot of suggestions out there in the golf architecture enthusiast community, the golf nerd community of which you and I are both a part, about what the club could do with the course to bring back some of its original features. A lot of these suggestions are not exactly realistic, but let me just lay out a hot take for you that I don't entirely agree with and just see how maybe you respond to it. The hot take is this. Again, this is not something that I totally believe. The ideal version of Augusta National, the greatest version of Augusta National that ever existed, was in the 1980s and 90s, after a lot of the changes that we've already talked about, after the original eighth hole was brought back, after the Robert Trent Jones 16th hole was installed, after Perry Maxwell moved the 10th green and the 7th green back to their current locations. All of that had happened, and the course became what it was in the 80s and 90s. Picture the course that Tiger Woods won on in 1997. Still extremely wide, no second cut, beautiful championship golf course, incredible championship golf course. Maybe the main problem that has happened over the past 30 years is this tiger proofing and the narrowing and the tree plantings and the introduction of rough. And I think actually a lot of people at the club would say, yeah, these are problems, but we've had to do these things in response to the changes in equipment technology. And obviously the club has advocated or been supportive of a rollback for a lot of these reasons. But what if I were to say the real goal here is to try to get Augusta National back to the form that it was in the 90s? How would you respond to that, and would you argue against any aspects of that?
All right, well, that's an interesting take. I wouldn't argue against, generally speaking. What I would say is, taking that framework, the course in the 80s and 90s, I would want to expand a lot of those greens to the original size. So that, you know, if we went back to single cut wide fairways, that's beautiful. That's all well and good. But I would also like to expand those greens and get some of those pin locations back that have been lost. And there's a lot of examples of this, but probably the easiest, best one to think about is the 13th hole. You know, there's been a lot of conversation the last few years about the 13th hole, and they, you know, last year is when they unveiled the new tee box, they lengthened it. You know, this was this par five that Bobby Jones had always talked about. The second shot was supposed to be this momentous decision. You know, do you go for the green in two and try to clear that creek, or do you lay up and play it as a three shot hole? Well, you know, with technology, the ball and the clubs improving so much, it's become essentially a par four for these guys. Well, they lengthen the tee, which is great. I think that that's, unfortunately, I think that that was needed for the Masters. But what they didn't do is restore the green. And that green was originally 13,000 square feet and had this big tongue in the front left of the green with another whole section that's gone that was tucked right behind that creek. You know, we were talking earlier about all those kind of amoeba-shaped tongues and stuff that were right up against bunkers. Well, in this case, that tongue was right up against the edge of the creek there. And currently, there's a big bunker right where that section of the green was. I think if you restored that green to its original size, had that pin location, that would create much more variety for pin locations for the tournament. And so if you had a, you know, on the 4 days, you have like a back right pin on one day and a front left pin on the other day, and then two other pins, that hole would play very, very differently. And where you would have to try to place your tee shot would be probably very different. So I think, and there's, you know, other holes are examples of the greens that have shrunk a lot. So I think just expanding the greens back would create more diversity in the strategy that these guys had to use, and would kind of keep them on their toes a little bit. It would give the club more flexibility in the day-to-day setup of the 4 days of the competition, and keep the pros like on their toes a bit. But generally, yeah, having the much wider fairways, less trees, I'm all in favor for going for the single cut. The other thing I would say is I sort of think of it in terms of like a hybrid. So if you were to take like, say, the current course with all of its infrastructure and all of the improvements they made, and then you imagine it like it's a hybrid between the original course and the current course, trying to get some of the rusticity back, sort of the rugged aesthetic of the original course, I think would be really interesting. Now, I recognize that the club has this reputation where the course is just very, very well manicured and just everything is dialed and perfect. And so I recognize that they would never go back to the rugged nature of the 1934 course if you look at those old photos. But I think that
they're not going to have like the turf the way it was. And no, if you look at some of those old photos, like it's this is what turf was like in the 1930s.
Exactly. Especially on like clay soils that weren't sand capped with little niche. So if you were to try to, you're just taking what's there now. But then I think if you just, with the bunkers specifically, if you just gave a little bit of rugged texture to the edges, still keeping them like very well manicured, I think that would help improve the aesthetic a lot. I know you would argue like, well, that doesn't really factor into the playability. It's just more of an aesthetic thing. But I think, again, like there's a good happy medium. There's a hybrid between, say, 1934, 1980s, and current day course, where you have the tees. You know, that's the other thing we haven't really talked about is like all the tees that have been lengthened since the 80s, which, I mean, what are you going to do? You can't go back to those tee boxes. You know, you could argue that they're already struggling in that department. And you know, that's why they lengthened 13 and then 15 last year. So I think at least for competitive play, I mean, for member play and guest play, that's a very different thing. And you'd have, you know, you have a different set of tees entirely. But for competitive play for the Masters, I mean, I think there's no way around it. It's like you need those new tees. And but creating the width in the fairway and expanding the green complexes, having those more, you know, those pinnable locations back, and then just adding a little bit of rustic character with some of the bunker edges, I think that would be like sort of the ideal way to approach a quasi restoration of Augusta.
The aesthetic issue is an interesting one. You know, how do you reintroduce some rustic character without making the course a weird mixture of refined and rugged? Right? Because right now, the aesthetic is very consistent through the course. It is all extremely refined and sharp, and that's what they've gone for. But I think that there is, as you're saying, a possibility of a happy medium here. And a course that comes to mind, and I'm not suggesting a new architect here or anything like that, but what leaps immediately to mind is the current version of Southern Hills Country Club and what they did there. That was initially a very rugged golf course. And would I have preferred that they went all the way back to that ruggedness when they did the Gil Hanson, Jim Wagner restoration there a few years ago? Probably that would be my preference. But what they did instead was a kind of compromise where they have some of that really, you know, the turf is obviously state of the art and everything does look really ship shape, but the bunkers have a little bit of that original shape, a little bit of that, chaotic look along the edges, but it all still fits. And it's not easy to do that as an architect, but I think it is possible. And then the other thing that you're saying about the greens would be maybe the easiest change of all. The green that leaps to mind for me, or two of them that leap to mind for me when I think of possible expansions, would be number 4 and number nine.
The boomerang. Yeah.
The totally. Nine used to be, I mean, nine is kind of more or less an oval at this point. It's a fairly big oval, but that used to extend way more down the hillside and maybe a little bit more around the top of the bunkers, but it was, as you say, a boomerang. And then four had this amazing section that wrapped down around to the left of the bunker. Now that green is fairly shallow and wide, but originally it was, almost again, a boomerang type shape with a big portion of it coming down the hill and around the bunker. Now, some of these sections would be unpinnable, but unpinnable areas on greens can sometimes be functional in the sense that you can use them to run your ball up and do different things in approaching the green. So those would be the two that come to mind for me as good candidates for interesting expansions.
I think you're right on the money. Yeah, I've looked at that a lot. And, if you could get that tongue back on four, again, that was modeled after the Eden. And if you look at the 11th hole at St. Andrews, there's a bit of a tongue going out in front there. And they just sort of exaggerated that when they built that, the fourth at Augusta. And then, to your point, that ninth hole, you have this boomerang. So you'd have like a back left pin location way over that bunker. And then it's a little unclear to me if the front left was ever pinnable or if that section was more of just a false front. I think that the very front right section, that sort of tongue, I believe that was more of a false front, probably wasn't pinnable. Mm-hmm.
That's what I think too. It would be a pretty radical pin if you put one there.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But you could do that. And again, I just think that it would keep these pros on their toes a bit more, having to navigate these different pin locations. I mean, they're so familiar with all of the current pin locations. They know those greens so well. So if you introduced some of these expanded greens, at least for the first few years, it would introduce, some more strategic challenges for them.
Well, Josh, you and I could go on for another 3 hours about this, but it would no longer be a podcast. It would be it would be more of an epic in audio form or an audio book. In any case, a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for coming on the pod. Can you give people things to look for that you're doing? I'm thinking about book, website, institute, all that kind of stuff. Where can people find some of the work that you're doing, either architecturally or historically?
Sure. Well, yeah, thank you, Garrett, for having me. Really enjoyable conversation. Yeah, I have a book that I published called The Mackenzie Reader, which is a compendium of all of his writings. Many of them had sort of been lost to time. And I sort of integrated all these different visuals. So it's a sort of interactive book with routing plans and photographs and all these writings. And there's, a good amount of material about Augusta in the book. And there's a whole section about it. So you can find that on my website, which is alistairmackenzie.org. That's the Alistair Mackenzie Institute, which I founded and am in the process of building a museum that will eventually exist down the road. So yeah, you can check with me there. I've got some social media, which sometimes I'm not great about, but I'm trying to get back into that. So on Instagram, there's Mackenzie Institute, and on Twitter X, it's Dr. Mackenzie. But yeah, happy to chat with anybody. And you can find the book at alistairmackenzie.org. And always good talking with you. A lot of fun.
All right, thanks for coming on, Josh.
Sure thing.
This episode of the Fried Egg Golf Podcast was produced by Matt Ruscius. Thank you, Matt. If you'd like to do something really quick to support the podcast, go to wherever you're listening to this, wherever it is, and leave a rating and review. Those really help us reach new listeners, and we like hearing the feedback. So if you could do that for us, that would be much, much appreciated. Thank you for listening to this episode, and we'll be back again soon. Thank you.